And I'm going to be sharing their experience in increasing acceptance of HIV prevention and treatment practices through religious leaders and their institutions in Southern Sudan. I have no relationship to disclose. A lot of you might know that Southern Sudan got their independence 2 years ago after a 40-year civil conflict that was really gruesome. So Southern Sudan is the world's newest and also youngest country, with over half of the population under the age of 18, and 72% of Southern Sudan are less than 30 years old. The war destroyed the little infrastructure that had been existing before, and the area already had a history of underdevelopment. So while Sudan is celebrating independence, which gives them prospects for development and peace and prosperity, the country is also inheriting enormous health challenges, one of them being HIV/AIDS. And although right now the World Health Organization generally thinks about or generalizes the epidemic in South Sudan as low, they have neighboring countries like Uganda, Kenya, DRC, Central African Republic, Ethiopia, and Eritrea that have high HIV rates. So in some parts of Sudan, the pockets of the epidemic are really high, where you have states that are neighboring countries with high prevalence for HIV. And this is sort of a picture of what you see the surveillance for HIV prevalence by state. Western Equatorial borders the Congo. Central Equatorial is Juba, which is also very close to the borders. When you have areas like North Bangwa, which are farther from any border areas, the prevalence rates are as low as 0 to 0.1. So for a long time, for the 40 years, Sudan was closed off of the world, literally. And with the signing of the peace treaty, you have all these countries coming in to bring trade, that essential commodities that they're bringing into the country. But you also have a country that has very, very low skilled workers. So you have immigrant populations coming in to bring skilled labor. And because they're coming from pockets of or countries with high prevalence, they are bringing the HIV to the host country. That's the same map showing HIV prevalence. And again, like you see, border states where you have the prevalence that is sometimes mirroring the prevalence in the countries that are closest to these areas. So what do we know about the determinants of HIV in Sudan? We know that there is low knowledge of HIV transmission. There is risky sexual behavior. And then there is just the situational risks of having post-conflict in the country that increases the risk of HIV. For example, the DHS of Southern Sudan 2010 shows that only 11% of women ages 15 to 24 know about three ways of preventing HIV transmission. Only 53.8% of women 15 to 49 years old have heard about HIV. That leaves 46% of women in that age group that have not heard about HIV. That is scary. Then you have about less than half of the women that can use the condom consistently, let alone be able to negotiate consistent use of the condom. These other areas that are other key determinants that are sort of culture related. In Southern Sudan, it's acceptable to have multiple sexual partners. So if a man slept with a woman today, essentially that woman can be a wife. If he can pay a dowry, then she's a wife. So you already have acceptance of multiple sexual partners. But then you have people that are HIV positive, that are continuing to marry or remarry, that are not using condoms. There is high stigma related to HIV AIDS because of discrimination. In Sudan, HIV AIDS is a mystery. It's a mysterious disease that they're hardly relating to risky sexual behavior. Then we have cultural norms, for instance, a widow inheritance. If a family pays 100 head of cattle for me to be married and my husband, we are HIV positive and my husband dies, I am still obligated to satisfy his brother sexually. The brothers, too, are mandated to reproduce for their deceased brother. So that is, whether I am HIV positive or not, I still carry on my role as a reproductive health machine in this setting. Then there are situational risks that just because of what is happening in the country, there is increased vulnerability to HIV AIDS. There's massive populations of people that are returning or being settled into different places. In IDP camps, it is common to have rape. You have refugee influxes of people that are looking for food or depending on food agencies. So they're looking for menial jobs and sometimes exchanging sex for food. You have ex-combatants that for a long time traveled from area to area fighting and spreading HIV as they moved along their life. And now that they have been disarmed, they are looking for work in any city where they can find work. And as they go along, they are spreading HIV AIDS. Then there's gender inequality factors. Women have the lowest status in the community, lowest education, lowest economic abilities, and the lowest level or knowledge of HIV prevention. And this is something that the Ministry of Health said in 2011. It said the legacy of more than two decades of gruesome war for the independence of the Republic of South Sudan is more evident in the health sector, where there is almost total collapse of the healthcare system. Now, people who work in Sudan will actually tell you it's more than just reconstructing a healthcare system. It is developing a healthcare system. So while the government works on rebuilding the healthcare system, they have had to come up with innovative and strategic partnerships for delivering healthcare to their populations. And they have forged partnerships with NGOs and especially faith-based communities. And they realize that the structure and systems of faith-based groups add value to services. And this is why in Southern Sudan, the most social event of the week is church. You can have people sit and overflow to the outside or sometimes looking through windows. Because unlike other African countries where the market is the place that you go for social gatherings, because they haven't had doors, the church is the number one place that gathers people by the hundred. Coupled to the other fact that in these areas where churches have provided services during and pre the conflict, there's very low access to reproductive health services. A regular Sudanese will have an estimated 0.2 contact with the healthcare system per year. Now compare that to the same individual having contact with a church for at least four times during a week. If they're not in the choir, they might be in the youth group, they might be in the men's group or the women's group, and then the church Sunday service. So there's no traditional practice of engaging with the healthcare system, but the church certainly can gather or mobilize all these people for treatment and services. So what the government of Sudan has done under the AIDS Commission is to have joint ventures with faith-based organizations and community-based organizations to engage them in planning, developing, and delivering comprehensive HIV care services for these populations. So CHAS, which is Christian Health Association for Southern Sudan, engaged with the AIDS Commission under what they call the South Sudan HIV Project. And they had three key objectives, which is to strengthen the capacity of the South Sudan AIDS Commission to plan and coordinate and monitor the national response to HIV. That also included increasing community access to comprehensive care services and creating awareness and measurable change regarding behavior indicators for HIV AIDS. So who is CHAS? CHAS is Christian Health Association for Southern Sudan. It's a Christian network organization of at least 72 members, and these come from varied and diverse faith traditions. They also include Muslim faith groups, a lot of groups of people living with HIV/AIDS, and their major goal or common goal is to be visible and effective in their contribution for delivering health care as the country rebuilds itself. So under the government of Sudan, CHAS was awarded a grant or a service agreement to provide technical leadership and management of the HIV/AIDS project in two states, that is Western Equatorial and Lake State, and CHAS then subcontracted 35 implementing partners. Now, a lot of the 15, the FBOs, are actually dioceses, whether it's Catholic or Protestant dioceses. Then you have community-based organizations, lots of associations of people living with HIV/AIDS, and then two government departments. So how has CHAS engaged faith-based organizations specifically to promote health and to carry out service delivery? They are very strategic in ensuring that these leaders give voice to HIV because the government didn't talk about it, nobody talked about it, because they have had enormous needs of simple basic needs like food and water, let alone even understand that HIV is critical. So the strategies that CHAT has used is to engage institutions and leaders to mobilize communities, to provide HIV-related care on their facilities, and some of that has been to actually expand or introduce HIV care services within existing service care deliveries for HIV, for faith-based groups. They have used churches and church groups as service providers. They have used businesses like radio stations that are church-based to actually do activities or do awareness, have people call in and have educational sessions. They have engaged community leaders and actually had churches host assessment for community need. And they have also used religious leaders to advocate for policy development and implementation of HIV-related services. So one of the approaches, like I said, that they have used for assessing community needs is what they call the Lord Quality Assessment. And what they do is you gather communities at a church setting, and they participate in identifying what they think are important key needs for themselves. They make decisions on how factors that affect their lives should be responded to. They formulate and prioritize and implement policies to improve those conditions, and they plan and develop and deliver services to sort of bring about change in their own communities. Another approach that CHAS has used is to train religious leaders, and this includes training them to use any gathering to give or to raise awareness about HIV prevention or what HIV is. So that could be a sermon, it could be a baptism, whatever. Whenever that the religious leader has a pulpit or gets on the pulpit, they give them very short messages about prevention that they can use. They have also trained, like I said, church groups to work as service providers, and those can be youth, mothers union clubs, catechist services. They have introduced or expanded HIV services in faith-based owned facilities that already provide care. And one big thing that they have done is linking, for instance, traditional healthcare systems to government healthcare systems, where they invite traditional birth attendants, because 80% of Sudanese women will deliver their children from home, even though they might come to antenatal care once during their pregnancy. So the church will have health providers from government bring those such screening services to the church compound. Sometimes people will come out for 2 days at a time and just camp at the church. As healthcare providers come, and the church will provide the food for them to come. Typically, before church is present in the country, you might have a report of 2 people or 3 visiting a healthcare center for HIV testing in a month. Now, when you bring those services to a church where the people are, you see those numbers going from 80 to 100. In 2010, church was responsible for 80% of HIV testing in the whole state of Western Equatoria, just because they bring the services to where the people are at the church and where they trust. They have integrated, like I said, weekly messages in their sermons, and again, engaging their radios or FM stations to talk about HIV. Another thing that is critical that religious leaders have done is creating a supportive environment for acceptance of people who have HIV/AIDS. But even more critical, they address issues of gender inequality. For instance, talking about delaying marriages for young children, and then talking against having a 10-year-old be married to a 70-year-old who has already had 10 wives and maybe has already exposed all of them to HIV, and then increasing male involvement in maternal and child prevention of HIV. So what has the contribution of, that we know, quantified our contribution of the church in Southern Sudan? Results from the AIDS Commission project of HIV showed that from baseline to end line, the contribution of faith was that there was increase in men's knowledge of transmission of and prevention of HIV/AIDS. And you can read the numbers for yourself. Look at Lake State, for example. That's an increase by 68%. There was an increase of perceived individual risk of contracting HIV for women, particularly in Western Equatoria. And the number of women seeking HIV counseling and testing services increased in both states. So why are faith-based organizations critical, especially in HIV, in humanitarian settings that also have HIV?
One of the reasons is because in developing countries, like some of you might know, faith-based organizations combined with the NGOs provide 90% of all HIV or of all care, health care. And now when you look at specific for faith-based, that is at least 40 to 50%. So one in five organizations in Sudan is working in HIV response, and those are faith-based organizations. But even prior to post-conflict, the church has been there, has been the first to uphold a call for humanitarian care, whether it's food, water, sanitation, they have been there. So they are really a relational and trusted voice in the community. And like I say, they have been bridging communities and organizations, aid organizations, sometimes actually creating safe passages for these organizations to bring care and food to people. So they already have a role of mobilizing and bridging communities and serving care organizations. And then again, like you say, they're very good at linking sort of the traditional and the new systems. Like I gave you the example of having a mother-to-child prevention services. So that is why we think it's critical, and half the time they feel ignored or people don't see the role that they can play. This is in your, I picked it right from your abstract so you can read it, but I'm just going to read the last one, that interfaith program activities have highlighted the differences in message packaging between different faiths in ways that are culturally accessible and acceptable to diverse cultural belief systems, influencing disease acquisition and response prevention, particularly in this population of Southern Sudan. And we thank you again for being here. If you have questions.